supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
The city of Bridgeton in deep South Jersey is experiencing an uptick in crime. I'm Dave Heller, and this is Newsworks Tonight. To combat the issue, city officials are driving more resources to policing, but maybe not in the way you'd expect, as WHYY's Joe Hernandez explains.
Sergeant Jason Hoverman is showing me around Bridgeton's newest police station.
So there's a desk, office chairs. On the back wall, we have two dry erase boards, and we also have a tack board in case we need to tack up a map.
There are also computers where police can look up records and file reports. Sergeant Hoverman isn't showing me around a new building. Bridgeton doesn't have the money for that. Instead...
Yeah, I mean, pretty much we have, you know, a Chevy box truck that we converted the box into a workspace. So
a box truck, or as Bridgeton police are calling it, the department's new mobile substation. The city is literally rolling out the police precinct on wheels at a time when shootings and armed robberies are increasing. Bridgeton has had 4 murders this year, too.
There's been a lot of instances here where I've been woken up at night and go bang, 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 there's gunshots.
Bob Koenig has lived in Bridgeton for 35 years and says the quality of life there has gotten worse.
And it makes somebody like myself, who's always had a decent place to live, want to pack up my things and get out.
City officials hoping to keep residents like Koenig see the new mobile substation as the best solution, both tactically and financially, to bringing down crime in Bridgeton. Mayor Albert Kelly says building a new substation doesn't make much sense.
If you have a permanent one in one section of the city, the bad guys move. And then we do not have the resources or the manpower to be able to have a substation in every sector of the city.
The real problem in Bridgeton is what cops call hotspots, specific areas where crime suddenly increases. Police in Bridgeton describe fighting crime in these areas like a game of whack-a-mole. They send resources to one hotspot only to see another pop up across town. Now, for example, if there are a few shootings on a certain block, police can park the mobile substation there and set up a temporary precinct. Patrol officers can come and go from the substation and do pretty much everything their job requires, short of booking suspects into jail. Again, Sergeant Hoverman.
It allows us to stay in that area, come back to this point, be able to do any type of reports we need to do, from taking any complaints from citizens or anything like that. Versus coming all the way back here to the police station removes the officer completely out of his area.
The mobile substation is a modern take on an old-time policing practice of having precinct houses scattered across town. But in cities like Bridgeton, budget cuts have forced many of them to close. Bill McKnight teaches criminal justice at Stockton University. He's also a former Atlantic City police captain. McKnight says those precinct houses helped build relationships between the community and the cops.
Citizens got to know the police officers. There was a local place that they could go to if they had a question or a complaint. It localized policing.
And that's the second purpose of Bridgeton's new mobile substation, to help with community policing efforts. Chief Michael Gamari plans to fill the truck with information for homeowners, like tips to prevent burglaries. Once the weather gets warmer, Gamari says, the department will drive the truck into different neighborhoods, throw open the back door, and invite residents in.
It gives the community a chance to interact with the officers in a positive way instead of only interacting with them when we're on a call and it's a bad situation. So
Gamari even wants to add a doorbell to the truck to make it as much like an actual police station as he can. From the New Jersey desk, Joe Hernandez, WHYY News.
The New Jersey Senate's Oversight Committee will hold a hearing tomorrow on the state's Board of Nursing. Some lawmakers and advocates say the board is improperly funded and understaffed to the point of crisis. For WHYY, Jeanette Beebe reports.
Keith Hovey says the New Jersey Board of Nursing is broken. He's an attorney who represents nurses who face disciplinary charges, from fraud to negligence. The problem, he says, is the board is backed up with so many cases that it can take months or even years to get a hearing.
They deserve fairness. They deserve their day in court. And they shouldn't have to work under a cloud as to whether or not they get to do the thing they believe they're called to do, simply because the current system allows them to languish into perpetuity.
One woman who feels called to nursing is Javi's client. She only wants to be identified by her family name, Valeros, because her case is pending. 3 years ago, she was fired from her job at a Monmouth County hospital. She was accused of falsifying records and not providing proper care. She's disputing these charges and says the board doesn't have the whole story. She still doesn't know how this will end.
I want to get my life in order. So I've dealt with anxiety. I've dealt with, like, mood swings. And, you know, I don't know what to do with myself half the time because of this. Like, what's going to happen to me? And not just me, but all the other people who are in limbo.
Last week, Governor Christie appointed 10 new members to the board, alongside 3 reappointments. Though this move fills the board, lawmakers holding the oversight hearing have other concerns. Democratic senators allege that Christie retaliated against 2 whistleblower board members, and the board still lacks a permanent executive director. For WTYY News, Jeanette Beebe.
Scores are up among New Jersey students taking the PARC tests. Helping us grade on a curve is NJ Spotlight founder, CEO, and education reporter John Mooney. John, welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight.
Glad to be here.
Well, on the face of it, that's good news. But first, a refresher. What are the PARC exams? When did they come into existence?
Yeah, New Jersey has been administering the PARC exams now. I think we're going into our 4th year. And we are one of now a half dozen states. It started as some 20 states that were doing the PARC exams. They're a new online test, language arts and math, given annually grades 3 through 8, and then again in high school at a variety of different levels. Being online, it allowed a quicker turnaround on results, more rigorous test, you know, at least it advertised as such, and had a little bit of a rocky rollout in the beginning. And in fact, families were opting out of the test, for a variety of reasons. A big pushback is around these tests are now being used to judge or to evaluate some teachers, not all teachers, but those who were affected in those grades and those subject areas. It is also, and has been for a long time, not the PARC test, but there's been a high school graduation test in New Jersey now for 20 some years. And now this has become the high school graduation test. At least it will be in 2021. But we're rolling towards that.
Question I have, perhaps playing devil's advocate, why does New Jersey still offer the test if it winnowed down from some 20 states originally to now just a handful?
That is a good question. The Christie administration is obviously in its last year, last month even, and I have asked them repeatedly, are they starting to negotiate to extend this test? The contract is through this spring. And so what is going to come behind it?
In addition to what's going to come behind it, who's going to come behind it? And if it's Phil Murphy, the Democratic candidate and the presumed favorite, I understand he's not a big fan.
His website says he wants to end it as a high-stakes test. So there's some – is it the test still exists and it's just how it's used? That's one question. Is it even the PARC test being given at all, the online element? I think that's – horses out of the barn. I think you're going to see more and more online testing. I don't think we're going back to paper and pencil on that. But certainly there's some variations on that. But he has said he does not want to use this as a graduation test anymore, which is, you know, there's a state law right now that allows the state to have a graduation test. So that may require some changes. And whether it's used for as well as for teacher evaluation, there's also a state law that calls for testing to be used as a teacher evaluation. So it's not just as easy as to say we're not going to have testing anymore, because, I mean, there's clearly going to have to be some kind of accountability measure. I think we're even required under federal law to have some kind. But what that's going to look like, he has yet to really shed a lot of detail on that.
Certainly, Murphy only has the students' interests at heart. But if hypothetically politics came to play, what constituencies is he satisfying by making
this appeal? Well, the big critics, the biggest critics of the testing, at least organized criticism, has come out of the teachers' union, NJEA, New Jersey Education Association. They were especially critical for the component that would affect teacher evaluations. And some would argue that they were a big piece of the opt-out movement in that first and second year. It would be hard for him to back off that position given the support he's getting from them.
Where does Republican rival Kim Guadagno weigh in?
She hasn't really weighed in a whole lot on it, but she certainly has not been critical of the testing regime. She has generally said that she feels that the state should have a testing regimen for students, and I'm pretty sure she has been in favor of using it as a high school graduation test. Now, that is something we've been doing for a long time, and as I mentioned, to change that would require not just the governor to pitch it, but the legislature to go along with it as well. And some of the big players in the legislature, namely Steve Sweeney down this way, has said that we need a graduation test. So this is not a necessarily a straight Democrat-Republican issue. There's a lot of different players who have some different opinions on it.
At the end of the day or the beginning of the next term, are you feeling that there's going to be a diminished partnership for assessment of readiness for college and careers in
New
Jersey?
Very good, Dave. You knew that. I think there will be a move afoot to be ending the use of PARC and making some real changes in our testing regimen again.
Thanks, John.
Pleasure.
NJ Spotlight founder, CEO, and education reporter John Mooney. The Philadelphia 76ers' first preseason game gets underway in under an hour, and for years the team has been bad by design in order to get high picks in the NBA draft and amass as much young talent as possible, and it seems to be paying off. This year there's a lot of excitement around the team and its budding stars. For proof, WHYY's Avi Wolfman-Arendt brings us the story of one man's dashboard video and the reaction it inspired.
Evan Bowen Gaddy was driving for the ride-sharing service, Lyft, in Center City Monday night when a 7'2" figure jogged across the intersection in front of him.
And out of the shadows comes Joel Embiid running, and I was so stunned.
Embiid is the Sixers' star center, and although injuries have limited him over the past few years, his stellar play and impish personality have made him an NBA sensation. For a fan like Bowen Gaddy, spotting Embiid was sort of like seeing Bigfoot.
I had like a couple seconds where I was just staring at the 7-footer. All I could say was, "Yo!"
Just then, Bowen Gaddy got an alert for a new rider. Luckily, the path took him right alongside Embiid. A few blocks later, he caught up to the big man and rolled down his window.
And obviously, I didn't say anything clever. I just kind of panicked and shouted,
"Yo, trust the process!"
That's the rallying cry of Sixers fans who've stuck with the team during the process of rebuilding, losing a lot of games, and stockpiling young players. Embiid has even adopted the process as his personal nickname. Back in the car, Bowen Gaddy had one more thing to add.
And then to make it worse, I just said, "I love you!"
Bowen Gaddy captured the whole thing on his dashboard camera. He posted it to a Sixers fan board online and didn't expect much. After all, it was just an awkward interaction with an overexcited fan. A couple of days later, the video has 40,000 views and has been picked up by ESPN, Sports Illustrated, and TNT, which took Embiid's head and placed it on video of another famous Philadelphian running through the streets. Yes, people are pumped about the Sixers again. Like, watch a video of Joel Embiid on a nighttime jog pumped. That's because after a rough four-year stretch, the team now has Embiid, Ben Simmons, and Markel Fultz, all top-level young talents.
It really feels like everything we've worked for is finally coming together.
Bowen Gaddy is one of the faithful. Each year he makes a wager with friends from Pittsburgh about how the Sixers will fare. This year, he bet them that they'll make the playoffs.
We make a yearly bet of like $20, which I've yet to win, but this is my year. I'm pretty confident.
And why wouldn't he be? After all, it wouldn't be the first time a Philly underdog made a comeback. Avi Wolfman-Arendt, WHYY News.
The early Stephen Sondheim musical, A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, is among Broadway's great romps, and a current production at the Walnut Street Theater exploits it to the max. That's according to WHYY theater critic Howard Shapiro, who offers this review.
If you're going to run fully in overdrive, the perfect stage vehicle is A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, a musical that takes the phrase, "You can't be serious," to heart. You just can't be serious at the Walnut these nights, where its frantic production can turn an audience into a laugh machine. The leader of the mischief is a hijinkster named Frank Ferrante, who plays the main role and also directs the show. His character is a conniving Roman slave who bargains with the son of his owners for his freedom. All the slave has to do is get the boy together with the girl next door. Sounds easy, but no. First off, the boy's folks don't want him messing around. Second, the girl next door sounds fine, but next door is a brothel. Third, she's under contract to wed a fearsome military giant who's on his way to get her. The score is one of Stephen Sondheim's early ones, but it's the zany script by Bert Shevelev and Larry Gelbart that drives the show. In fact, only one Sondheim song escaped the show into popular culture, and it opens and closes A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum with gusto.
Something familiar, something peculiar, something for everybody comedy tonight. Something that's funny.
That's the entire Walnut cast, which plays along with Ferrante, who's quick to smash that invisible wall between audience and stage, which the show's script encourages. In fact, he uses just about any reason to ditch the script and cajole the audience to more laughter. The cast features plenty of Walnut stalwarts, an array of some of the city's best acting talent in this show that piles deception on deception, each funnier than the last. So when in Center City, do as the Romans do, and no, you can't be serious. A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum runs at the Walnut Street Theater through October 22nd. I'm Howard Shapiro for WHYY.
For culture lovers, Philadelphia has had an embarrassment of riches lately. September was dominated by the Fringe Festival, Opera Philadelphia's O Festival, and the start of the Benjamin Franklin Parkway Centennial Celebrations. Well, now as the calendar turns, we turn to another festival coming up this weekend. WHYY's Kimberly Haas spoke with one of the performers, John Kolpitz, and Mark Christman, executive director of Ars Nova Workshop, the presenters of The October Revolution.
So, John Kolpitz, Mark Christman, welcome to Newsworks tonight.
Great to be here.
Thank you.
So, Mark, to start, we've got the October Revolution coming up, and we're not talking about Russia. We're talking about Ars Nova's latest project. What's it all about?
It's a festival, the October Revolution in jazz and contemporary music. It takes its name from the great trumpeter, composer, conceptualist Bill Dixon's festival of a similar name in 1964.
Did you struggle with a simple way to label what sort of festival this is?
In today's world, terms like jazz and classical and what have you are very limiting and perhaps even unnecessary. Contemporary music of all kind has been the foundational focus of Ars Nova. But the artists that we continue to present really go well beyond these sorts of definitions. Lots of visionary ideas and real innovative thinking on the stage. And these artists, I think, go well beyond the idea of the ecstatic jazz musician on the stage performing.
John, you seem to be a man who's chafing at the labels that get applied to music, given just the depth and breadth of what you do in so many different contexts.
I love being able to present my music in a really wide range of venues. So the Ars Nova October Revolution Festival is ideal. And then I've also played with this project at, you know, the Philly venue, Kung Fu Necktie. I think I just try to focus on creating the music and not worrying too much about the labels and the titles.
What's the inspiration or occasion when you move on and create a new group?
I think it's really about opportunity. One of the projects I'm doing at the festival is my duo with Jim Sauter, a saxophonist who started really what's considered the original noise band. And I got a chance to do an album with him in a larger context, a band context. We had a great rapport musically and personally, and we just started playing in it. So it's really just about what relationships I can take on personally and musically. It's really that simple.
So, John, you've brought in Man Forever, one of your groups today, and today with you is Matt Evans and Austin Vaughn, and you're going to play an excerpt of an instrumental version of one of your tracks. Can you talk about it a little bit?
It's called 10,000 Things, and I developed the piece with Matt's group Teague. It's a percussion trio. It's three different meters stacked on top of each other, so you can hear three, four, and five beats going on. And Matt's playing a saw blade. That's kind of the ringing bell-like tone, which I always loved. So it's a composition that cycles in a way that feels a little bit odd and strange, just because of the, it's like a 15-beat permutation that cycles and builds.
So Mark, the October Revolution lineup, I mean, we talk about contemporary musicians really expanding beyond the music labels, but some of the people in the lineup have been doing this for a very long time. We've got the Art Ensemble of Chicago coming in, Anthony Braxton, even David Torn's been around for a long time, and of course our own Sun Ra Orchestra.
The folks you just mentioned, they are, you know, important forces in this music and the reasons for which Ars Nova has even existed. To find opportunities, to find a place where their work could be elevated. It could be presented in Philadelphia in an environment that really respects them, respects the work, and creates a space in which everybody kind of owns it and is there in a deeper listening environment. And whether we're talking about the Sun Ra Orchestra or the Art Ensemble that's been around for 50 years, or we're talking about John and his work, you know, we're talking about artists who are part of this constantly evolving art form.
The October Revolution Festival starts on Thursday and runs through Sunday, mostly at Fringe Arts, also at Neighborhood House at Christchurch. I've been talking with Mark Christman, Executive Director of Ars Nova Workshop, and John Kolpitz of Man Forever and many other groups. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Mark Christman and John Kolpitz spoke with WHYY's Kimberly Haas. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller, NewsWorks Tonight.